Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that's Rashawn Roland Kirk, the great Rashawn Roland Kirk, born on this day in 1935. And you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, celebrating 88 days of summer. Today on the program, we'll bring you some of our favorite segments from the past two decades of The Mark Steiner Show. What you're about to hear is a pre-record, so we can't accept any calls. Please send us any feedback to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. We are about to have a conversation with McKay Jenkins, who has written this book called What's Gotten Into Us? Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. And McKay is the Cornelius A. Tillman Professor of English and Director of Journalism at the University of Delaware, but lives right here in Baltimore, Maryland. And McKay, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this book, you know, when I first saw the book, I went, do I want to read this book? But it's one of those things where we think about all the time, see all the time, but then we don't.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very common reaction to this. The idea that there's a lot of stuff out there that people intuitively think or intuitively know are bad for their health or bad for the environment, but they know that by asking a few questions, they could open up a big can of worms. They might have to do some dramatic things to change their lifestyle. And I think the prospect of changing their lifestyle is so intimidating to them that they'd just rather not know. The thing is that the scientific evidence for some of the harm that these chemicals can do is mounting to the point that it really would behoove people to just think a little bit more clearly about some of the things that they consume in their daily lives, some of the practices that they might have. And the truth is that once you get past your initial level of anxiety, this can actually be a very empowering set of information, because just like with smoking, you may go for many, many decades and keep smoking and pretend that you haven't heard the science somehow. But the truth is, once you change your behavior, you can have demonstrable benefits for your health. And the same thing is true here.
Well, I do want to explore that a bit more, because there is a lot you can do, but without a social, political upheaval and change, you really can't do it. You can't do what needs to be done.
I am really glad that you mentioned that, and this is a very important point to talk about, because there are basically two ways to think about this. What we're talking about are synthetic chemicals that are in everyday consumer products. Now, you can think about this in two ways. You can think about it as, like I said before, similar to smoking, or you can think about it as similar to climate change. Now, you may give up cigarettes and you may improve your health. That is fine. But that's not going to save you from going into a bar and having somebody blow smoke in your face. You can drive a Prius and you may have a marginal impact on your own carbon footprint, but it's not going to do anything for the atmospheric change. So what you need to be able to do is not only think more clearly and alter your own behavior, but as you mentioned, you've got to start imagining this as a collective imperative, that we have to figure out a way to bring some of these regulations into line so that we can keep these out of everybody's hands. I mean, if you think about one thing we should talk about today, for example, are lawn chemicals. Mm-hmm. Now, if you think about our lovely Chesapeake Bay, if you think about the number of acres of grass that are being sprayed with pesticides, for example, or being fertilized with synthetic fertilizer, you may only think about your own half acre or your own quarter acre. But if you think about the cumulative impact of all those synthetics after it rains, running into creeks, running into streams, running into the Chesapeake Bay and creating these massive dead zones, you get a sense of the collective problem that we're talking about.
Well, let's take a step backwards. I mean, I enjoy the way you started the book, which is kind of what pushed you into this in a way, was the guy who sees himself as a physically fit runner. You look like you're not carrying the weight you don't need to carry. You're trim. But you got this you had this pain, and all of a sudden had this diagnosis that you thought was cancer. And you figured, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, this was about 5.5 years ago. I went to see an orthopedist with what I thought was a running or a cycling injury. And he said, this is probably just some ligament problems. You may have some tightness in your hip or something, but let's just take a quick MRI to see, make sure everything is okay. So we did that. And then at about 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, the phone rang. And he said, you know, we've got the MRI back and you have a suspicious mass in your abdomen and you need to call an oncologist right away. And this was absolutely the last thing I imagined happening. At the time, my kids were about 5 and 1.5 years old, and when you are told that you have a tumor in your gut as a parent of young children, it's a very traumatic thing to hear. And so about a month, my wife and I ran around trying to figure out what this thing was. And lo and behold, we found ourselves on the schedule of a surgeon in New York City. Went up there, and just an hour before I went in to get cut open, I was approached by some public health researchers with clipboards, and they said, "You know, do you mind if we ask you a few questions about your health before you go in for surgery?" And I said, "Sure." I mean, I was at the time obviously very distracted and preoccupied. But they sat down and asked me a whole battery of questions about my chemical exposures. They said things like, "Have you been exposed to formaldehyde or lead or mercury or stain resistors or flame retardants or you name it?" Just this long, long list, dozens and dozens of chemicals, and all of these chemicals are present in our everyday consumer products. And as I was asked these questions, I had to tell them that I've only had two careers in my life. One was as a newspaper reporter and one was as a college professor. This is not – you're not talking to somebody who's worked in a petrochemical plant or right. formulating, you know, synthetics.
So you do work in Delaware.
I work in Delaware, right, and I live in Baltimore. So, you know, I do have some environmental exposure. But clearly these questions were meant to make me think about the chemicals that I'd come into contact in just normal life. And it occurred to me – after the surgery, of course, when I could think about other things, that if I'd been exposed to all these things, then everybody had. Now, in my case, the surgery turned out to be terrifically positive. They pulled this tumor out. It was the size of a baseball. And he said, lo and behold, it's benign. And I said, what number of these tumors that you pull out are benign? He said, 4 out of 100. So I somehow went into a month-long of absolute terror, and then they pulled it out, and it was all fine. And people said, "Well, how's your health these days?" My health was never in question. Like, I was never sick for a day in my life. But the questions about this thing that had been growing in my abdomen really stuck with me, and that kind of launched me into this investigation. And if I may, just the very yeah. first thing I decided to do was figure out if I had been exposed to all this stuff, and clearly I had been. I wondered if there had been any science or any research into the kinds of chemicals that are in most people's bodies. And what I decided to do was go up to the state of Maine, and I interviewed dozens of people up there who had been part of what they call a body burden study, where they submitted samples of their urine, their blood, and their hair to a laboratory, and they spun it through and told them, "You have in your body, walking around every day, flame retardants, for example, and you have Teflon chemicals, and you have phthalates, the plastics that you find in soft drinking water bottles, and you have bisphenol A, which is the plastic that you find in old Nalgene bottles and that sort of thing." Dozens and dozens of chemicals in all these people's bodies, many of whom had grown up in the most rural part of one of the most rural states in the United States. So the question was, if these people have all these chemicals in their bodies and they live in rural Maine, think about somebody who's walking around the streets of Baltimore on a given day. And the net result, of course, is that everybody who's ever been tested for these synthetics has them in their body. Now, they don't then say, therefore, you will get breast cancer. The science cannot do that yet. What they can say is that these chemicals in a rat in a laboratory will cause breast cancer, and you have these chemicals in your body. Now, making that next jump is something that they're still working on.
Now, I mean, there was an interesting chapter on Maine in the beginning of the book. And what you just said, I think that it bears some exploration, because we're not talking about people who – we don't ingest the bottle.
Right.
We ingest the water that's in the bottle.
Right. This is a jump for people, because they say things like – I mean, I mentioned this anecdotally in the book, for example. There was a time when my wife and I were cooking. Now, we'd been working on this – I'd been researching this book for a couple of years. And one night, my wife is making spaghetti sauce, and she opens a can of really expensive organic canned tomatoes that we got at Whole Foods. You know, had to spend like a week's salary to buy them.
Yes, I know those tomatoes.
Yeah, they're great. They're the best tomatoes on the market. And on the can, now those of your listeners who have read Michael Pollan know about this whole thing about how when you buy vegetables, especially at a place like Whole Foods, you have to be able to read. There's a whole system of reading the labels, so it'll have a picture of a farm and cows and farmers and all that. It makes you feel really warm and cozy about that. Well, this can had a big picture of a farm, and it said organic tomatoes, and it said this can is made without lead, and everything is all hunky-dory. But my wife had heard recently that canned vegetables are often lined with this bisphenol A plastic on the inside of the can. So she calls up the company and says, "Is it true that you have bisphenol A, which is an endocrine disrupting chemical, on the inside of your cans?" And they said, "Yes, that actually is true." And so then the question became, well, if these are organic tomatoes, but they're in a can that is lined with bisphenol A, and scientists have been able to prove that these chemicals leak from the can into the tomatoes, should these tomatoes be considered organic? I mean, they're taking up this plastic. Now, they're organic because they weren't sprayed with pesticides, but they're suddenly absorbing the chemicals that are in the can. So this is why consumers get so frustrated, because they can't win for losing. Like, they try to buy organic vegetables and find out that the cans have these toxic chemicals
right.
in them. So you may drink out of a water bottle. The one that has become most prominent in Maryland, there's been the Maryland Public Interest Research Group has been pushing to get some laws passed to get bisphenol A out of products, especially the ones that come into contact with babies. So, for example, for years, when a parent would wake up at 3 a.m. and go downstairs and put a bottle of breast milk on a stovetop to warm it up to feed their baby, what could be more normal and natural than that? But it turns out, of course, that these plastic bottles were made with the same chemical, bisphenol A. So the chemical in the bottle is leaking into the breast milk. And, of course, when you warm it up on a stovetop, it leaks in even faster. So when women found out that chemicals in the bottles were leaking into their own breast milk, they became really infuriated. And you see this in state after state. And in some countries, like Canada, for example, the women, especially mothers, have gotten so outraged by this, they have formed an effective political lobbying group and have gotten a lot of laws changed. And this is something we should talk about, but it turns out that women really hold the key to many of these political fights, because they are the ones who are aware that these chemicals can pass from their bodies to their infants' bodies. And in time after time, and in my book I talk about this in Maine, women lead the charge, because women have kind of a moral authority. When they go up and lobby in front of a legislature, the opponent, I mean, the industry can hire all the lawyers they want, but when it's nursing mothers on the other side of the equation, legislators tend to pay attention.
You have an example in your book, and you'll have to refresh my memory as to the chemical we're talking about, between Maine and California, where Maine outlawed this particular chemical. This young woman Hannah Pengree led this fight in the state legislature. She was a young legislator to ban this chemical, and they won, and the chemical lobby fought against it in the pattern you're talking about. But the same thing happened in California, where the chemical lobby just dumped tens of millions of dollars into this campaign to block it, and they lost.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that Maine
was the chemical? What was it that they were banning again?
This particular case was flame retardants.
Oh, that was – it's in toys and everything little kids use.
Well, there are all kinds of things. There are flame retardants in things like mattresses and children's pajamas and all that. Then there are these other chemicals called phthalates, which are in things like rubber duckies and stuff that your kids play with. But I think the one you're thinking about is these flame retardants. Now, if you think about this, flame retardants are fat soluble, which means when they get in your body, they tend to cling onto fat cells, which means logically that they accumulate in breast tissue. Now, what you find is, like, in a place like Sweden, Sweden did one of these really world, very prominent study in Sweden, where they found out that all of these chemicals were accumulating in women's breast tissue, and they found out that they were all coming from these products made with flame retardants. They banned the flame retardants, and the number of chemicals in women's breast tissue declined by 30% in 3 years just by banning these flame retardants. Now, in Europe, it turns out that there's a very different mindset about the chemicals. They are considered to be guilty until proven innocent, meaning that industry is compelled to test these chemicals before they put them on the market. In the United States, we have a very different idea. What we decide is that industry can introduce whatever chemicals it wants, and if somebody somewhere is able to prove that they got sick, got cancer, or they got some kind of developmental problem because of a particular chemical in a particular product, then they will consider banning it. Of course, it's extremely difficult to prove that. So what you find is that there are something like 80,000 chemicals in use today, and only 5 have ever been banned, because it's extremely difficult. Once the horse has left the barn, it's very, very difficult to get a chemical banned. So when you're talking about Maine versus California, what happened in Maine is, in addition to being a very rural state, is a very poor state. And so when a bunch of women got together and said, we want this stuff out of these products, they went up to the legislature and they pushed this law through. And then all the outside of the state lobbyists showed up and tried to convince these legislators not to do it. But the legislators realized, of course, that they had no industrial constituents, because there's no industry in Maine. So why would they vote against these women, who in fact were their constituents? In California, and Maryland is somewhere in between, where you have a lot of very progressive political actors, but you also have a lot of very well-heeled industry, the battle is much more fraught because industry can come in and they can lean on the legislator and actually have an effect on the way they vote through their campaign contributions, through their political organization, all that sort of thing. Maine was a good example, like Sweden, where you had a state legislature that was very sensitive to its own constituents and not to outside industry. And that is a very common way that you can get these things banned.
When you, what you mentioned a minute ago, it was in the very beginning of your book, there's a, you talk about this, about how our country's consumption of synthetic chemicals in the last 25 years has increased by 8,200%.
Yeah.
8,200%. And that, but just talk about what this means. I'll just read what you wrote here real fast. By the mid-1970s, there were some 62,000 chemicals in use. Today, the number is thought to be, as you just said a minute ago, closer to 80,000. The Environmental Protection Agency has a full set of toxicity information for just only 7% of these chemicals. And the U.S. chemical industry has a $637 billion business. And 99% of those chemicals we use today have never been tested for their effects on human health. Only 3% have been tested for any carcinogenic possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
That's...
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. And I really – it's important to make clear here that this book is trying to tackle a couple of different things. It's trying to tackle the science to figure out what do we know about these chemicals that go into our everyday products and what kind of health consequences do they have. But it's also a book very much about culture. Now, one thing I found interesting in the research for this is the Titanic. When the Titanic went down in 1912, the most luxurious ocean liner ever made, when they finally brought that back to the surface, all these marine archaeologists went onto this boat and they started pulling stuff off of it, chandeliers and jewelry and cups and plates and silverware and all this kind of stuff. And they found that in 1912, there was not one single piece of plastic on that boat. The entire boat, the way it was constructed, all the stuff that people had left on that boat, there was no plastic. That was 1912. Now, 30 years later, World War II is going on, and this incredible industrial machinery is starting to really crank up. And again, people will recognize this from Michael Pollan's work on the industrial food industry. When you start to develop industrial chemicals, for example, synthetic fertilizers, the entire industrial food system is built on synthetic chemicals that were discovered and many uses found for them in the middle of the century, right around the World War II. And the same thing is true for all these petrochemicals that went into consumer products. So 1912, no plastic. 1940s, huge industrial revolution going on. And for the last 60 or 70 years, every single thing that we come into contact is made one way or another out of these petrochemicals. I mean, just think about it. Look around your room. Walk through your day and look at things that are made out of stuff that is not is not wood. It is not wool. It is not cotton. Look at things that are made one way or another out of synthetics. And think how used to that stuff is that you have become and how you have just accepted all these different products as part of your life. And then you ask yourself, what do I know about the constituent components of all these products? How do I know that these things are safe? Well, the reason you know they're safe is because someone has told you they're safe, whether it's through advertising or whether through you understand that the government must have at some point approved this, so therefore you either trust the industry or you trust the government. But as soon as you look a little bit closer at the relationship between industry and government, you find out that really nobody is watching the hen house, that the relationship is very tight, and industry is extremely powerful at convincing government not to police them. A lot of the policing that happens in industry is self-policing. So, for example, you have a $60 billion a year cosmetics industry. Now, cosmetics are virtually unregulated in this country. And one thing I did in this book in chapter 3, my wife and I walked through a big box store.
Your big box chapter, yeah.
Yeah, we walk aisle by aisle in a big box store, and we look at labels, and we look at what's on labels, and we look at what's not on labels. And it's astonishing to see what is labeled and what isn't labeled. So you can, for example, walk into the automotive section of a big box store, and you can find a product that will be labeled. It'll say, this product is made with chemicals known to be carcinogenic. And you say to yourself, oh, okay, well, I don't want to buy that product if it's carcinogenic, but at least there's a label, you know. Then you can walk across the store and go into the cosmetics aisle and you can pick up a product. And there will be no label on that product. And it turns out that that product is made with exactly the same chemicals that are in that carcinogenic automotive product. But because of the way industry has been allowed to function, they don't have to label it. So now the question would be, which do you feel safer doing, putting a carcinogen on your engine block or on your face? or on your lips or on your fingernails. And the way that, you come to accept that because you assume that somebody is watching out for your best interest, but the truth is they really aren't.
But one of the things that hit me, and this is something that the industry would argue back, and by the way, we're talking with McKay Jenkins. His book is What's Gotten Into Us, Staying Healthy in a Toxic World, a really interesting book. At first, I didn't want to read it, and it was a lot of me just completely depressed. But instead, I was got a little pissed off, and but also realized the things we can do, and which we'll get into, and kind of. But we need to understand what's going on around us before we can even think about what's happening. If we understand the problem, we can begin to maybe address that problem. And let me just tell you as well, as we continue this conversation, that you can meet McKay Jenkins this week, Wednesday night, June 8th, at Dish and Dine at Dogwood, that is being sponsored by Breathe Books. And we'll give you information at the end of the hour how to contact that at Breathe Books and get over there and have dinner and a great conversation. So, but one in this book, there's a part where you talk about at the very end of the book about how certain chemicals that we think are carcinogenic or are labeled carcinogenic but there's no real, it seems like there's no real backup or proof to that for most people. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
I'm going to find this piece in the book, but that to me seems to be part of the problem, is that it's suspected of. It may be. We may consume all these plastics and synthetics, but there's no real confirmed link between breast cancer and the chemicals that are in us.
That is a very, very valid point, and it's something that's worth talking about. Now, let's think about it in a couple of ways. One question is, why is it that people feel doubt about something? So something is labeled carcinogenic, and they say, well, I'm not so sure that I believe that. Now, this, again, brings up the question of things like climate change, where, you know, you'll read a whole bunch of studies that say climate change is happening, and then you'll read something that says climate change is not happening. And so your head is kind of confused, and you're thinking, well, maybe the jury's still out on this. Maybe we're not absolutely certain. But, when you look at climate change, the vast preponderance of science says that it's happening. And what industry does to confuse you is it'll create these studies that are meant to muddy the water. They're not trying to prove that it's not happening. They're just trying to make you a little bit uncertain of yourself. So there's that component. It's what you call manufacturing doubt. Like there are whole arms of industries that are trying to confuse the science on this. So that's number one. So the doubt is being planted. The second thing, of course, is that it, in fact, is very difficult to prove that your breast cancer came from this particular chemical. It's very difficult to do that. And this goes back to this whole question of body burdens. So one person I interviewed said, imagine that your body is like a barrel. And all day long you go through your life and you put on lipstick and you put on shampoo and you put on sunblock and you cook an egg on a Teflon pan and you take a nap on a mattress that's made of flame retardants and you walk across a rug that you haven't vacuumed in a while and you find out that there are pesticides in your house that blew in from your neighbor. And, you know, you're breathing in paint from your hallway at the office that's just been painted and on and on. And then you eat some sushi and you've got some mercury coming in that way. You've got dozens and dozens of chemical exposures all day long, every single day of your life. That, in fact, is true. That is, in fact, happening to every single one of us. Now, let's say that happens for 25 or 30 years. And then let's say you develop cancer or you develop a developmental problem or you develop a reproductive problem or whatever it is that you develop. Can you then go back and say it was that paint back in 1987 when I was working? No, of
right,
course you can't.
Right.
You know, so it's impossible to do it. But if you're thinking of your body as a barrel that day by day is filling up with these chemicals, nobody knows what an individual chemical can do to you, nor do we know what these chemicals do in combination with each other in your body day after day after year after year after year. But I will tell you that there is a certain segment of the cancer research community that will say things, and I quote somebody in the book that says, the war on cancer has been lost. We pump billions of dollars into this to try to figure out ways to cure it or surgically remove it, but there's very little effort to prevent it. And this is one of the things that we're talking about, is trying to figure out ways, if this stuff is even potentially a problem, why aren't we paying more attention to keeping it out of our bodies?
One of the things that struck me about the cancer research, this is not in your book, but you talk a bit about it in the book, is that, and it made me think about that as I read that part of the book, was that every time I've had an interview, conducted an interview about cancer research, we've done many of them over the last 18 years, you learn that less than 4%, let's say in breast cancer, of all the research money goes into the possible roots and origins. Mm-hmm. Are there toxicity? Is it something in the environment? What are the factors that might lead to it? It's always most of the money goes into genetic studies or into certain treatment studies, but not into what's causing it. Right. And that's what you're talking about here. And that goes across the board for cancer research. I think it's because we're probably terrified to find out what it really is, or industry and government are terrified to find out what it really is, because then they might have to do something which could cost billions of dollars.
Well, I think those are very, very good points. And I think there's another component to it, which is that we live in a culture where we are convinced one way or another that we will be able to find a technological fix to every problem that there is.
Right.
So the idea that you're going to find some magic pill that's going to cure cancer is a perfectly American way to think about things. That somehow some scientist in a laboratory will come up with a miraculous cure for cancer, for climate change, you name it. We'll figure it out, a way to cure it without actually having to look at the root causes of our own behavior. And that's a very adult way to have to think about things, which is to think long term and to think root causes, not miraculous mythological fixes.
We're talking with McKay Jenkins. His book is What's Gotten Into Us, Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. McKay Jenkins is a professor at the University of Delaware. He's a Cornelius Tillman Professor of English, Director of Journalism at the University of Delaware, and lives here in Baltimore, Maryland. Stay with us. We'll be right back for round two with McKay Jenkins, What's Gotten Into Us. And we'll talk about what's gotten into us, what we can do about what's gotten into us. Stay with us. You're listening to an archive of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, celebrating the 88 days of summer. And we'll be right back in just a minute. On our way to break, we're hearing After All This Time by Rodney Crowell,
there were
born
trains,
on this day in 1950.
And we outrun them. There were songs and we outsung them. There were brighter days, never ending. There was time, and we were burning.
I remember one September on a Friday night, Staggerly and Billy Lyons had a great fight. He's a bad man, old cruel Staggerly. Well, talk about your gamblers. Oh, to see that Richard Lee, he shot $100 and he come out.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Staggerly by the New Lost City Ramblers. Mike Seeger died on this day in 2009, one of the founders and major singers for the New Lost City Ramblers. And you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. And this is just a reminder that we're listening to an archive of The Mark Steiner Show this hour and cannot accept any calls. But please send your thoughts to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Now back to our segment. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're talking with McKay Jenkins, who has written a book, What's Gotten Into Us, Staying Healthy in a Toxic World. And McKay, while he lives here in Baltimore, is a Cornelius A. Tillman Professor of English and Director of Journalism at the University of Delaware. McKay, let me just start this way. I'm going to read a comment by Theo Colburn, mm-hmm. that's in your book. And she is with the National Institute of Environmental Health. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
All of this, Theo Colburn and her colleagues write, suggests that over the last 50 years, quote, synthetic chemicals have become so pervasive in the environment and in our bodies that it is no longer possible to define a normal, unaltered human physiology. There is no clean, uncontaminated place, nor any human being who hasn't acquired a considerable load of persistent hormone-disrupting chemicals. In this experiment, we are all guinea pigs. That's a pretty frightening little few sentences.
Yeah, you know, that sentence reminds me of the first time I read Bill McKibben's book about climate change, which came out in 1989, where he said, at this stage of human history, there's not a single square inch of the planet that a human being has not had an imprint on them. I mean, their foot may not have touched it, but our pollution has touched it some way. And now what you've read there is the fact that our industrial production now is contaminating every single cell of every living thing. And I mean, this is not just human bodies, of course, that you find this stuff in wildlife like crazy too.
It's the fish we eat.
Yeah, and I mean, this book has – there's some anecdotes here about places – strange places and in strange creatures that we have found synthetic chemicals. For example, they can find synthetic man-made chemicals on the top of Aconcagua, which is the highest mountain in South America. They can find toxic chemicals in the bodies of Inuit fishermen in the far northern Arctic. They can find beluga whales in the northern St. Lawrence River that have breast cancer. Now, how is that? I mean, how is it that we're finding synthetic chemicals in the most remote places, the most remote people, the most remote animals on Earth? These are not, you know, animals or people that are walking around northern New Jersey or walking through the cancer corridor in Louisiana or places like that. But what you find out is that the volume of these chemicals that are being produced to make everything that we've been talking about, not just things like gasoline, but all the plastics, all the consumer products, the volume of chemicals that are being made to make this stuff is enormous. And, you know, you when we were all kids, we were always told things like, you know, if you drink out of that plastic bottle, it's going to go into a landfill and it's never going to break down, they would say. Well, that turns out actually not to be true. I mean, everything breaks down. It may break down invisibly and over time, but the truth is that all of these chemicals break down. Now, if you, for example, there's a lot of science studying a very mundane thing, and that is the dust inside your house. Now, let's say you swab your finger across the windowsill of your window. You can find in that dust, if you were to look at it in a laboratory, you can find things like the flame retardants that have sloughed off your mattress, for example. You can find the stain-resistant chemicals that have come off of your wall-to-wall carpeting. You can find not only the pesticides that your neighbor sprayed on his lawn last week, but you can find DDT on the windowsill of your house. And DDT has been banned for 40 years, but the stuff sticks around. So in other words, it's not that it doesn't break down. It does break down, and it blows all around the world. So these chemicals produced in enormous, unimaginable volumes end up somewhere, and where they end up is in our bodies. This is the end result of this, is that our bodies absorb stuff that we come into contact with. And it's finally – this is why these body burden studies are so interesting, because – finally, some of these health groups and environmental groups have figured out that showing not just that chemicals show up in a river somewhere, and not showing that, you know, that frogs are growing three eyes or something. That's the old technique of trying to scare people about environmental impacts. Now what they're trying to do is show that these chemicals are in your body right now. Now, you may not have cancer. You may not have a hormonal problem. But as we said before, in a laboratory, these very same chemicals can cause that stuff. Now, is this enough information for you to be concerned? In Europe, the answer is yes.
The European versus American response is very interesting in your book.
Right. So in Europe, if you can show that chemicals are dangerous in a laboratory and you can show that chemicals are everywhere in the environment and in people's bodies, that's enough to ban these chemicals. In the United States, we have decided that's not enough, that are going to continue to let this industrial machine keep running unchecked. And I think that it's time to start thinking about this. This is not a particularly good time to be talking about government regulation. This seems to be a time where everybody hates the idea of regulation. But we are already living in a totally unregulated world right now. And what does an unregulated world look like right now? The world it looks like is that people walk around with these toxic chemicals in their bodies.
I mean, there are things in here that I just like a couple of things I want to throw out. And I want to talk about, and then I want to go talk about Europe a bit too, and what's it called, REACH, mm-hmm. the legislation in Europe, mm-hmm. Which has markedly changed things. Because the big question is, can industry change? Can we produce things without making them with chemicals on a mass basis for us to use, mm-hmm. in the 21st century is the big question to be answered as well. But you have this thing in here, because you're always wondering, why is there such an early onset of puberty in children, especially in girls, in our society, and even to a greater extent among African-American young girls? Why is this onset of puberty? So there's been all these theories. It's the milk. It's this. It's that. It's this. But it's interesting that this came out in the portion of your book talking about hair care products.
Mm. Yeah, well, African American hair care products for years, you could pick up a copy of, say, Ebony magazine, and they would have an advertisement that would be bragging about how the chemical, or I'm sorry, about how the hair care product was made with hormones or even placenta. This is a kind of a cultural tradition. And lo and behold, that a lot of these chemicals, whether they are natural, whether they're synthetic, mimic, that is to say, they mimic human hormones. So that when they get in your body, they start messing around with that great orchestra of your hormonal system. So hair care products is a primary example. But the other thing, and you mentioned this with the Theo Kolbern quote earlier, other chemicals that go into things like plastic bottles also mess around with your hormones. So, for example, you may have read stories in the last couple of years about these scientists that have found fish in the Potomac River that are changing gender. So, for example,
right.
They'll find male fish that are having eggs, and they're finding female fish that are growing testes, and they can't understand what would be happening to fish that would cause them to change gender. Well, one of the theories is that they're exposed to so many of these chemicals that mess with their hormones that they're actually changing gender. Now, you mentioned early onset puberty. That's something that young girls have been showcasing. The thing with boys is you see a national epidemic in what they call low sperm density. So what you're finding is that boys' hormonal systems are also being altered or gummed up by what they think are these environmental chemicals. So when you have a lot of these chemicals that are, you know, people talk about cancer a lot, but there's an entirely different set of concerns, which is the hormone-disrupting chemicals. And when you have chemicals that can get in your body and imitate or mimic or disrupt your hormone system, you can get things like early onset puberty or a low sperm count. So it's not just cancer we're talking about. It's interrupting the body's systems in a broad array of ways.
Some of the people that you interviewed are arguing, and this is really interesting to me because I've been wrestling with this for a while, and your book put in some context that I'd like to explore in somewhat greater depth over the years, is that some people are arguing of the potential link between some of these chemicals we find from everything from baby toys that little babies suck on that are full of chemicals, to the plastic bottles we heat babies' formula in, to the toys that they play with that are dangling from the ceiling when they jump and put in their mouths, to all this stuff, to the incredible growth, and I forget the number, but you'll remember, I'm sure, in cases of autism in the United States of America. Or what I've seen is the incredible leap in multiple sclerosis and in other nervous disorders in our society, and what may be the links. We don't know, but what we need to find out if there are those links.
I think this is a very, very good question. And autism is something that is so fraught. There's so many people, there's so much of it, and there's so many people whose lives have been influenced by this, and there's so much theory out there that I tried very hard to stay out of that argument, only because the science on autism environmental chemicals seems to be at a comparatively early stage. I mean, I think if we could stretch ahead 50 or 100 years and look back on where we are right now, we would think about this as an early stage, but a very convincing stage of the birth of this science that is connecting environmental chemicals with human health problems. Now, as we've said over and again this morning, at this particular moment, it's virtually impossible to say this causes that.
Right.
But I think when we look back on this, we will think, just like when we started to look back at the cigarette industry, for example, how could we not have trusted our instincts when we knew that this was a problem? Right now, we may be in the early stages. We may be being told that, you know, we don't really know yet, or the jury's still out, or the science isn't clear. That may be the discourse right now, but I don't think that's going to stand up over time. I think over time we're going to look back at this as the beginning of a stage where we got smart about the chemicals. Because don't forget, we're talking about World War II is when all this stuff started. These chemicals have only been around for 60 or 70 years, and the science is only just beginning to figure out what these things do. We lived, I mean, I hope we can talk about this, but we lived for many decades and centuries without all this stuff.
I wasn't going to jump to that yet, but I'll jump to it because I'm going to get to reach, but I want to read some other stuff that give people a sense of the chemicals that are in our world. It makes me think of the movie that many people watched in the late 60s that we all loved in my generation, which is The Graduate. And when the guy leans over to Dustin Hoffman's character and says, "The future, son, is plastics."
Right.
Plastics.
He was right, wasn't he?
And so, but the question is, okay, that was an era where there were, all through my father growing up and even into my childhood in the 50s, there were a lot of things that were not made with chemicals still. But the industry was growing and things were changing. And you talk in the book about, in Europe and other places, and other people were experimenting in America in certain chemical industries, how to create certain products without using petroleum bases and chemicals and trying to find some natural ways to make the things we use. But the question is, can we, in this material world, actually change that? Can we have a world where things are not chemically based, given the last 60 years have altered everything, the cheapness of it, the massive supplies of everything? Can that change?
Well, this is why this book is as much about culture as it is about science. Now, for example, if you say to yourself, excuse me, can you imagine a world where people don't have cell phones? Well, you know, I don't know how
– I didn't grow up with cell phones.
Yeah, 15 years ago, we didn't have cell phones.
Right, now
it's unimaginable. Can you imagine a world where you don't have Teflon pans? Well, yeah, because we lived for a long time without Teflon. We used this thing called olive oil to keep things from sticking in a pan, you know. It's not inconceivable that we can actually live the way we used to live. So this is very much about culture as much as it is about
science. I have to scrub a little harder, but it doesn't hurt.
It doesn't hurt, right. You know, again, so you mentioned growing up in the 50s. My favorite example of this is the Great American Lawn. Now, this book has a whole long section about lawn chemicals.
It does.
And if you think about lawns, now, you may look out at your grass and you say, that looks really nice. I just mowed it. I just sprayed it. Everything looks perfectly geometrical. It looks just like my neighbor's lawn. But then if you ask yourself a different question, which is, why is it that that appeals to me? Like, why is it that that has come to be the great symbol of an American landscape? It wasn't always that way, it turns out. And what you look at is, if you look at the history of say, Levittown, where, you know, after the war we came and built, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of houses overnight, and everybody moved in. Everyone was looking exactly the same as their neighbors. These places, I'm sure you've talked about this in other shows, these places were racially homogeneous, mm-hmm. but they were also ecologically homogeneous. So a Levittown lawn was mandated to look like everybody else's lawn. And then when the lawn care industry figured this out, they said, this is a major profit center for us because we can make everybody's lawn look exactly the same by spraying chemicals and keeping everything from growing except this one kind of plant, which is grass. And then everyone got used to it, and now for the last 50 or 60 years, that's what we're used to. But that's not because it has to be that way. That's just because that's the way it has evolved. Now, what you'll find in the book I mentioned, this colleague of mine named Doug Ptolemy, who is a great proponent of replacing lawns with native plants, because what he does, he's not talking about health. He's talking about ecological health. And what he says is, if you look at the total number of lawns in the United States, it's the size of Nebraska, which is a big freaking chunk of land. And if you think about what it would take to mow Nebraska once a week, all during the growth, I mean, try to think about mowing Baltimore County. I mean, you mow Baltimore County. Now think about what it would take to mow Nebraska or spray Nebraska. And you think about the cumulative impact of all the chemicals that are going on the lawn or all the petrochemicals that you're using to mow and what that would do to the watershed. So we're talking about the Chesapeake today. We've got all these dead zones in the Chesapeake. The piece in the New York Times recently about what's happening with all these chemicals running off in the Mississippi River and with all these floods going down into the Gulf of Mexico, creating dead zones that are gargantuan and they are hugely destructive. This is, again, the cumulative ecological impact of the use of these chemicals. So it's not just about human health. It's also about collective ecological health.
And it could – I mean, the idea of changing our lawns, we can don't want to spend too much time on it right now, but I was very taken with that little piece of the chapter for some of our other stories we do on our On Delmarva series. We want to talk about that with him, about how you do that.
Yeah.
I hate lawns.
Well, let me throw something really quick.
Yeah.
So what if you could live in a world where your neighbors looked up or admired your lawn, not because it looked like uniform green grass, but they admired your lawn because your lawn had more butterflies than any other lawn in the neighborhood. The reason you'd have more butterflies is because you'd plant plants that butterflies like to eat, and you'd have thousands of monarchs and swallowtails and all this, and everybody would come to your yard and admire and say, wow, how'd you get all those butterflies? I want those butterflies. That would be a very different paradigm. And that's imaginable. I mean, that is not an inconceivable paradigm, right? That's just a different way of thinking about things.
Now, one of the things that I think is important to kind of put out here, as we've talked about it just briefly, is what the European Union did with their REACH legislation. Why it's been so difficult to get it done here in America. And so there's a tale, two different tales of how to control the chemical industry and how to change it.
Yeah, I mean, Europe, again, this is kind of like this culture of anti-regulation we have here. There's also a culture and has been for 10 or 15 years about being suspicious of the way Europe does things. I understand that. But Europe generally, I mean, this is a bit of an overgeneralization, but Europe has more of a public health consciousness than the United States does. And what I mean by that is that they tend to look at the downside of industrial production more clearly than we do. We tend to think about industry as a creation of products and a creation of jobs.
Right.
We don't particularly think about what the downside might be. And in Europe, and particularly in places like Scandinavia, they're much clearer about the potential downside of industrial production. And so this REACH legislation came about when these European states decided that they wanted to regulate these chemicals because they were getting concerned about the health consequences and the environmental consequences. In this country, you know, to be a politician and to speak openly and constantly about your concerns about health and the environment is a political loser, it seems. People have not been able to get elected to high office by making the environment and health their primary thing. I mean, we think about the healthcare debate we had. What was it really about? It wasn't about the stuff we're talking about changing the health system so that we can prevent cancer. That never came up. It's all about money. And what we're talking about here really is a public health inspired politics. And that's what you see in Europe. And that's what you see in Maine. And that's what that chapter was about.
But in Europe, I mean, you talked about in this chapter, this argument in a couple places in the book about the money it would cost to test every chemical, the 80,000 chemicals we're using in America, which is step number one. Mm. Let's test the chemicals.
Yeah.
And who should pay for that and how much it would cost.
Right.
And it would not put the chemical industry out of business if the government conducted the tests and they had to pay for it.
Right. I mean, this gets into a little bit of economic theory. And you know, you talk about things like internalized versus externalized costs, for example. So if industry says, oh, it's going to cost us too much to test these chemicals. Well, if you think about the health consequences that somebody is paying for down the line as a result of these chemicals, who's paying for that? Do you know, like when you're talking about something being expensive, it's like saying it's too expensive for us to test food that you're telling us is making people obese, so we're not going to do it. Well, when obesity becomes a massive public health nightmare like it is right now, someone is paying for that. Someone is paying to take care of all the obesity and diabetes, but it's not industry. This stuff gets shoved down the line, and the same thing is true here. You know, this is, again, it's common sense that a little bit of prevention can actually, in the long run, be a huge money saver, but it's that initial pain that people think about and resist rather than the long-term benefits of it.
One of the things you're saying in Europe that this REACH legislation did, it can't happen here, but you talk earlier in the book about the hundreds of millions of dollars that the chemical industry spends during the Bush administration and even during this administration as well under Barack Obama, that the chemical industry spends on political campaigns and on Congress and on lobbying that doesn't take place in Europe.
Right. So a couple of months ago, I went down to Annapolis. You know, Maryland is one of the states that is trying to do some – the feds are doing basically nothing to regulate chemicals, and some states are starting to do this, and Maryland is one of them. And I went down to Annapolis with some people who work for the Maryland Public Interest Research Group, and they were going to try to lobby some of these legislators. Now, a public health research group has people who are working for it that have to go out and solicit money door to door just to pay their own salary. I mean, these are like 24, 25-year-old college grads. And for them to make a living, they have to go knock on your door and ask for contributions to pay their own salary. And who's on the other side of the argument? You know, these million-dollar-a-year lawyers and lobbyists that are working for these industries. So you've got a hotshot, highly paid lawyer on one side of the debate going into a legislator's office. And then you've got a college grad who has to go knock on people's doors to pay their own salary. And they are competing for this legislator's attention. So who is going to have more influence on – you know, you're just some legislator in Maryland. You've got two people coming through your door. You've got a college grad and you've got this a fancy lobbyist. Who are you going to listen to? Who's going to be able to twist your arm? This is the way the politics actually looks right now. You've got basically volunteers from brand new college grads on one side and you've got industry lobbyists on the other side. That is not a fair playing ground. If you're a legislator, it's pretty easy to be convinced by one.
Now, I mean, you say that in Europe it's going to cost – it would cost companies €2.3 billion over 11 years to test these 32,000 chemicals. Mm. That is only 0.04% of the industry's annual sales.
Yeah.
Of course, it might change the entire industry. They might have to redo everything they're doing.
Well, but you know, I'm glad you said that. Now, let's think about this for a second. Let's think about what regulation might do to industry. You know, it also might create enormous opportunities. So, for example, in Maine, again, we keep talking about Maine. Maine is a very poor state, as I said. There's a county in Maine called Arista County, far in the farther northern part of the state, and everybody up there are these out-of-work potato farmers. Now, what if you could create an industry where you can make plastic out of potato starch? Now, this is something – if you walk into, say, Atwater's in
plastic
Baltimore,
out of potato starch.
You can make – people are already making plastic cups out of corn starch. It's very it's being done right now. Let's say you could come up with a way to make a plastic cup or a plastic bottle out of a natural product like corn or like potatoes. That would create an entire new industrial opportunity for an alternative product. Do you know? So like when we're talking about regulating or changing things, it's not all eliminating things. It's just coming up with different ideas. And this country is famous for coming up with ingenious new ways of doing things. This could create all kinds of markets. And you see this in the cosmetics industry. If you pay any attention to cosmetics now, there is a huge niche for people for products that are advertising how completely organic they are. This is something that these companies have figured out, that there are people who are demand, just like organic food. Once you create an industry that people are worried about, that creates enormous opportunities to create alternative possibilities. And there are all kinds of opportunities, organic lawn care, organic consumer product manufacturing, all this sort of thing.
I can hear people that are hearing, listening to us and saying, so you're telling me all these chemicals are bad? The chemical industry is all a waste? You've got to do away with the entire chemical industry in the world?
No, I'm not saying that. And, you know, what people say is that life is better. People are living longer. You know,
better through chemicals.
Yeah. No, all I'm trying to suggest is that people pay a little more attention to the products that they're buying and try to figure out what's in them. How do they know what's in them? Who's telling them what's in them? How do they trust that piece of information? And do just a little bit more. I talk about what's called mindfulness in here. It's like instead of just reacting, sort of knee-jerk reacting when you walk into a store and you're automatically buying the same old product that you ever bought, is to like reach for something and pause for a minute and think, what's in this product and how do I know? And is there something that I might buy instead of that? Because once you do that, once you have a moment's judgment or a moment's pause to think about alternatives, you are suddenly exercising your power as a consumer. You're basically saying, I am thinking about this product and I am going to give my money to a company that's making something that I feel more confident in. And if you do that and enough people do that, that's how things change. You can change things by being a better consumer or by being a political actor or both. But this book is meant to make people feel empowered, not despaired.
Right, and it does show how people can organize and get this thing done and come and make a political force. And to think about everything from the lead paint in the toys, your kids' backpacks, your kids' lunchboxes, these little vinyl toys for babies and little children that we have, and even the caulking that you write in the book, how you used to put the best way to get the caulking. I did the same thing, was to run your finger down. Because that was the easiest, best way to get in, but it's full of toxicity.
Right, and that's
one
of
the better ways to do it.
I'm not so sure. I mean, the grout, actually, this is one thing that was really because recently, this is after the book came out, I tried to re-grout the tile in my bathroom, and I could not find a grout that did not have a big label say, this is carcinogenic, and I'm sitting there breathing this dust in, but I got to grout the bathroom, so what are you going to do? For all of you engineers out there, here's a growth opportunity. Find out how to make grout that is not carcinogenic.
McKay Jenkins, What's Gotten Into Us, Staying Healthy in a Toxic World, a really interesting book. It did not depress me. It just got me excited and energized. And McKay, great to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavromis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And that's Rashawn Roland Kirk, the great Rashawn Roland Kirk, born on this day in 1935. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.